Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. I often lament that it's easy to grow numb reading about and listening to the news day in and day out. There are so many problems, so much suffering, so many competing interests for our goodwill, let alone brain power. It's simply not possible for an ordinary person to keep abreast of all these events, no matter how much we read, how hard we try. And then sometimes I feel like I'm getting inundated with information I already know something about, have read a lot about. It can all become overwhelming. But there's reading about something, and then there's seeing it. Nothing like coming face to face with a problem to make it really hit home. That's what happens in today's program. Way up in Barrow, Alaska, the northernmost city in the U.S., a group of people are learning firsthand about climate change. They are face to face with it. Some of them live there. Some are only visiting and hoping to take their newfound knowledge back to the countries from which they came. They see climate change as a big problem, but not an intractable one. Today's Soundprint airs as part of Pole to Pole, an international media celebration of the International Polar Year, produced with support from the National Science Foundation. From producer Irene Quayle of Radio Deutsche Welle, this is Climate Change College.
You can really tell all the old ice is melting and it's not as stable as it used to be. So it's more dangerous. Yeah, it's really dangerous nowadays. You know, from here to where the lead is, sometimes there's cracks along near the shore and we gotta always keep an eye on the ice. And even on a real calm day, the ice will be traveling. And when it hits, closes back up, man, it's like thunder. It just crashes and pressure ridges and really dangerous. We've had close calls, barely made it out sometimes.
It's a cold grey evening in Barrow in the Arctic region of Alaska. Jeannie Dipido is standing outside the house of her whaling captain beside the remains of a bowhead whale, red and bloody against the snow. A group of young Europeans in thick parkas and snow boots are listening intently to the seasoned Inupiat hunter and her tales. We've come here on a field trip to the northernmost settlement in the USA, Barrow, or Utpiavik, as the Inupiat call it, the place to hunt the snowy owl. These days, it's the centre of the North Slope region, a place of contrasts, the home of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and the National Petroleum Reserve. Most of the residents are Inupiat, descendants of a people who first settled here more than 1,000 years ago. Amongst them is Alice Drake, who brought us here tonight. She's in her 20s, a modern working mum with a one-year-old daughter and a strong commitment to the traditional Inupiat Eskimo lifestyle. Here come the Greenpeace mob, one of the locals' jokes, as Alice takes us over to the captain's house, where the whole community, including us, has been invited to a traditional feast, the sharing of the whale.
Inupiaq means the original people, and we've been here for thousands of years, and our culture is based upon whaling and traditional living and subsistence hunting, and so we hunt the whale for year-round food, and the ocean is our garden. We don't have gardens up here. And it's important to us that we also respect the whale. It's a gift given to us from God above, and we also have to follow laws when we do whaling so we can continue our subsistence way of life.
But things are changing for the Inupiat.
The ice pack has been coming in later and later. Usually the ice is on our shores by October, but the last few years we've still had open water in December, so that's few less months for the ice to gain its thickness. And also in the summertime, we usually have ice floating around out there, and you can see it on the horizon, but the last few years you haven't. It's been several hundred miles out, inaccessible, and also the animals live with the ice pack. That's how they survive, and we survive by having the ice pack close to us. When the ice pack is far off, it's hard hunting and hard searching for it.
Outside, Kayan, another young Eskimo, has parked his snow machine and is standing by the remains of the whale carcass, talking to Kara from Ireland, who's around the same age.
Oh, give me alternative energy. Give me a solar-powered snow machine. I'll use it.
Yeah.
Use it. But you're the future of Barrow then, are you?
It's a little different.
Yeah.
Because we do ice fishing in the fall and caribou hunting in the fall. And just, I mean, all families just take what you need. What you'll sustain over the winter.
And you share.
Definitely. If you came and you said you wanted a caribou, we'd give you what we had. That's what most families are. Like, we're sharing people. I mean, that's how we survived, you know.
God, I wish everyone was like that. I'll take that back to my country.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah. I came here with the idea that all whaling was bad and that I just could never agree with any kind of whaling. But after talking to the locals and seeing how important whaling is for them as just about the only source of protein for them, and how they eat it on such a regular basis and they share it within the whole community and they don't sell it, I came around to the idea that if it's done sustainably, and it appears that they really try and do it sustainably, that maybe in this case it's understandable and it's acceptable and important.
At home in Ireland, in addition to working at a university, Cara runs a website on environment and climate-friendly home renovation. It was this commitment to the environment and her performance in a tough selection process that got her here. Philippa Marshall is the communications and sustainability manager with the ice cream company Ben & Jerry's, which runs the Climate Change College in conjunction with the global conservation group WWF.
Part of this trip is to understand where climate change is having real effects right now, and to get deeper into the science and arm the students with the arguments that they'll need to convince the people back in their home countries that A, climate change is really happening and that it's caused by man-made reasons.
Here in Arctic Barrow, science and Indigenous knowledge go hand in hand in documenting and assessing the impact of climate change. Involving the community in scientific research is one aim of the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium, or BASC, which is hosting the Climate Change College students. Glenn Sheehan is the director of BASC. He explains why one of the world's key Arctic research facilities is located here, where the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas meet.
You have to go back to 1881 and the first international polar year. There was an expedition to Point Barrow. Data from that IPY is still in use by scientists today. So there's 125 years of background data that's been developed here in Barrow.
Amongst those scientists working here in the current IPY is Dr. Chris Petrich from the University of Fairbanks, Alaska. He's getting his skidoo or snow machine ready for an expedition out onto the frozen over Chukchi Sea, and the Climate Change College team will be helping him to take some measurements.
We are up here in Barrow at least once a month to take a snapshot of the snow conditions, of the ice conditions. We're having a project here to characterize the melt of sea ice, to see how melt ponds form. And these melt ponds, they're much darker than the ice around them. And depending on how big the surface area of the ponds on the ice is, the average reflectivity, the average albedo of the ice may be bigger or smaller. And the most crucial and unknown thing actually is the snow cover on the ice. A thick snow cover means that little solar radiation gets into the ice to be absorbed there. So the ice stays relatively cool, while a thin snow cover means that the sun is easily able to warm up the ice a little bit. And as the ice gets warmer, there are brine inclusions inside the ice, and these start to melt the ice around them. And at some point, you get an appreciable amount of meltwater that runs through the ice.
I'm standing here on the sea ice. You'd never believe we were actually standing on the Arctic Ocean. The ice is surely more than a metre thick here. It's also pretty thickly covered in snow. We got here across the sea ice on a collection of skidoos towing a sort of wooden sledge which has 2 to 4 people on the back. It was quite an experience. It's bumpy, it's windy, it's very exciting, and it's not the worst way to travel in these kind of conditions. I've come out here with Chris Petrick. We've also got the students from the Climate College, and of course we've got our bear guides. One of them is just coming back on the skidoo. They're patrolling around with a rifle because a polar bear could pop up here anytime, and there have been quite a lot around here recently.
So I suggest that you find a spot with relatively level snow.
Level.
Okay. Measure the snow thickness with a stake. Then take a shovel, clear away the snow.
Yeah.
And drill a hole straight down, as straight as you can.
Okay. Shall we do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So they're going to measure the thickness of the ice here under the snow cover. This is a magnet probe that allows us to measure the ice thickness very, very easily. It's basically, we stick a pole into the ice, push a button, and then this data logger logs the thickness of the snow and the GPS location where we are.
Are you freezing?
The hands are getting a bit chilled in spite of the double, triple mittens.
Yeah, it's a windy day today. It would be interesting to see what the wind chill is. So here's the GPS.
You're doing really well.
Well, it's important if you drill that the drill goes in, and with taking up the drill, you remove the slush.
Practical advice from a hands-on teacher. Mark Cornelison is the man who thought up the Climate College, a polar explorer who's walked to the North and the South Pole. Now he's making sure Felipe Alves from Portugal and Erica Naga from the UK know exactly what they're doing.
So it's drilling, and then you pump out all the slush so it's completely clean and you can read it out clearly.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Are you sweating?
Actually, I'm very warm. Which is a lot better than 5 minutes ago. The trick is to keep active. I'm just quite surprised how little ice there is. We just measured there's 1.40 meters in ice. I was talking to a native resident about an hour ago, and I asked, is this normal? He said, well, some parts it's 20 meters deep, some parts it's 8, and some parts, as you can see, is 1.40 meters. It's a bit unnaturally thin. And he said maybe as little as 20 years ago, everywhere would have been 20 meters deep.
You've just taken this measurement. What contribution is it going to make to the scientific research project?
Basically, he will incorporate this data in other models, and these models will help to predict exactly how much of the heat that's coming from the sun is actually trapped into the atmosphere, how much heat is going back to the universe, I would say. And this, it's a very important variable in terms of global warming.
As Chris Petrich explains, Felipe has got it right. This fieldwork is an essential basis for creating the models to predict the future of the Earth's climate.
The next step is to take this model and boil it down to a relatively simple equations. So we turn the sea ice and the snow and their physical properties into a black box. Into a black box of very simple equations that can then be stuck into a larger scale model, a regional Arctic model or even a global climate model. It is well known that climate models have a hard time to predict the sea ice albedo accurately. It is getting better successively, and so we're contributing to this progress that is taking place.
As the expedition team packs up to return to base, I catch up with Inupiat bear guard Joseph Prook, who's been scouting around in the white parka he usually wears for camouflage while hunting on the ice, keeping an eye out for polar bears.
The climate's really changed. Last summer it was kind of strange because we started getting like a lot of new birds, plants, and like insects and stuff coming up. Last summer they just seen a moose, so that was rare because we don't get any moose up here. And then past year they seen a albino muskox just right up here. This is like the strangest thing everybody's seen up here because we don't have any muskox, wolves, wolverines, moose. Grizzly bears, there was one last year.
Changes in the region's animal and plant species are important indicators of climate change. We're on our way to a rendezvous with Dr. Katie Walter from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, and her research assistant, Laura.
In the past few years, I've been working with colleagues to understand how much carbon is in permafrost and what the fate of that carbon is. So when permafrost warms and thaws, especially in environments where lakes are at, the permafrost carbon is converted to methane, a very strong greenhouse gas.
Katie has a lot of equipment to transport for a long day's work out on the lake. We've loaded a power drill, shovels, bags and boxes onto a motorised cart that can get across difficult terrain. Piles of snow, bumps of frozen earth, ice and scrubland.
We're in a place where there's surrounded by permafrost or frozen ground. And I'm out here with the Climate Change College. So we are collecting different kinds of dead plant matter and lake sediments and permafrost samples so that we can look to see which of those materials produces the most methane. The ultimate goal of this research is to understand how much methane is coming out of Arctic lakes and what are the drivers of that methane. How important is permafrost thaw? How important is the growth of terrestrial and aquatic plants? And what is the significance of this methane for climate change? Actually, what we're looking out for now is the very end of the season, so the ice has already reached as thick as it's going to get, and it's already beginning to melt. So we're looking for places where, for our safety and for our methane research, we're looking for places where the ice is very weak, and it's weak because the methane bubbles that are trapped in the ice, those are the first things to melt. And so you have to be careful, because if you step on one of those, you could go straight through.
Yes.
This, I think, is a methane hotspot. If you see there, the ice is being kept open by the high rate of bubbling, and you can see those bubbles coming up to the surface and popping, and those are presumably methane. So we're going to trap some of that and test it in the lab and make sure it is what we think it is. And yeah.
Okay, how does this trap work?
It's just basically a plastic umbrella that we will submerge, and the bubbles will be trapped in the umbrella and funneled up through this bottle here, and we'll be able to collect it through this nozzle. Pretty simple contraption, but effective.
An exciting opportunity for the Climate Change College students to see scientists monitoring global warming firsthand. Erica Naga is the UK's climate ambassador.
We've been helping Katie and Laura find hotspots. We're up creek here with Laura, where she's visiting one that she found previously, and she's put her little umbrella contraption on top so she can capture some samples. And the others are out on the lake drilling giant ice holes, and hopefully going to find some pockets out there as well.
Back at Basque, the students have the chance to talk to George Devokey, an ornithologist. For more than 30 years, he's spent his summers on Cooper Island, 25 miles east of Point Barrow, observing a colony of seabirds, black guillemots.
As I started looking at 2 to 3 decades of data, I saw that the date of egg laying was getting earlier, which was somewhat surprising in that it indicated that melt was taking place substantially earlier. And that was running along with some of the observations in Barrow that also indicated that snow was melting earlier. But it was only in the late 1990s that I realized that the population was responding to a warming environment in a different way. That same increase in temperatures was changing the ice offshore, which the guillemots depended on. Black guillemots feed on Arctic cod, which is a small 15 centimeter long fish that is very high in fat because it lives right under the pack ice. And since it is right under the pack ice, birds don't have to dive very deeply to find it. Since there aren't many species that are feeding directly under the pack ice, there's not much competition. So guillemots, we know from looking at a certain chemical structure of feathers, feed on Arctic cod throughout the year and have fed on Arctic cod up here since the first specimens were ever collected in 1860. In the 1990s, the ice became less accessible. Their favored prey that was right under the ice was no longer as close to the colony as it had been, and as a result, the population started to decrease.
The past 2 years have seen the Arctic sea ice diminish to the smallest extent ever recorded. This has brought subarctic species such as horned puffins to Cooper Island, and it has also brought polar bears, probably the best publicised victims of climate change, to areas they'd have avoided before.
They don't have the platform of the ice to sit on, and they come to land. And this is a rather safe place because it's away from the mainland and is a safe haven for them. By far the worst was a young male that we could not scare away, and the bear wrecked one of our tents and kind of poked around a little bit, but it went by us rather close to where we were standing. We went back to the camp and called the search and rescue helicopter because we'd had just too many bears and we just felt we should leave the island.
As we leave the Basque Lecture Hall, across the hard-packed snow, on a dazzlingly bright but windy Arctic day, I ask Cara from the Climate Change College what she took out of George's story.
I just thought it was great the way George was so able to relate his very narrow research on the guillemots to the bigger picture with climate change and polar bears and puffins and all the other species that are important to the Arctic environment.
What was the most important message about the bigger picture that you took out of that?
Well, the most important message for me is just how rapid everything is changing. One of the things that George said I thought was really interesting was that he used to tell people that none of these changes with the sea ice completely melting would happen in his lifetime, but in his children's lifetime. And now he's saying, actually, all of the sea ice will melt in his lifetime, and that really scares him. And that was just such a dramatic thing to hear from an expert.
Professor Hayo Aiken is another of the experts working at Barrow, one of the world's most knowledgeable sea ice researchers. He confirms the observations of his ornithologist colleague about the problem of erosion.
As the ice season gets shorter and the ice is removed earlier in the spring, and in particular as it forms later in the fall, and as you have more open water, the wind that blows over these open water areas is able to generate larger waves. Those waves then interact with the seafloor. They start moving sediment around. And, of course, as they come crashing into the coast, or in particular as you have storm surges or storm flooding, are they capable of not just removing a lot of material, earth and sediments from the coast, but they also transfer heat very effectively to the land, which accelerates the melt of the permafrost, and which in some areas, in particular in western Alaska, has greatly accelerated coastal erosion.
And this is where archaeologist Anne Jensen comes in. Erosion doesn't only complicate life in the present, it's destroying evidence of the past, including the heritage of the Inupiat. Almost 10 years ago, out at Point Barrow, a few kilometres north of Barrow, Anne was called in by police when human remains were discovered on the beach. It turned out to be a large, ancient burial site dating back more than 1,000 years. The speed of erosion has increased so dramatically that her archaeological work to document and secure the human remains and artefacts here, much of it in conjunction with volunteers and local high school classes, is becoming a race against time.
Okay, we're at Nuvuk, which is also called Point Barrow. It's the northernmost point in the United States. The site is also located in this point. We usually have slightly warmer weather for excavating, but we've dug in wind this bad a lot. And sometimes we do have snow. We usually don't have it on the ground, though. And sea ice usually for the first, 3-4 weeks of the season, yeah, the ice is still in and, you know, bears roaming around. It's fairly normal. That's why we have bear guards.
There are various sites of archaeological importance in this region going back over 1,000 years. Anne explains why she's working on this one.
This is eroding faster than anything, and because it's a graveyard, it's a great concern to the community. And it turns out it's also scientifically very important as well. So it really is coming to understand more about these people, how they lived, and what it can tell us about why the Thule people spread across the North American Arctic. But just as important, really, is in fact recovering people's relatives before they wind up in the ocean.
Measurements show that Point Barrow is losing more than 6 metres a year from erosion, compared to 2.5 metres a year back in the 1940s, endangering sites which could provide the key to our knowledge of early cultures in the Arctic regions.
I actually have a little bit of money in the grant that I'm currently working on to go do a little bit of testing at Pechenek, a site that's in the literature is Burnick, the type site of the Burnick culture, which is actually a U.S. National Historic Landmark. That's an old site too, and it looks like the lagoon, which is just over there, is actually, because sea level's coming up, or maybe the land there is sinking, or maybe both, that it's starting to encroach on the backside of that site. So it may start to have a big erosion problem fairly soon, and we're actually trying to look at that now to see if we can figure out if that's coming and maybe start making preparations for dealing with that.
Jakob Rutqvist from Sweden and Art van Feller from the Netherlands were also moved by the trip to the snow-covered burial site with Anne Jensen.
For me, I think it was really interesting to see how global warming is affecting so many different aspects of life and aspects of the world. Like in this case, global warming is indeed affecting history.
All these kind of things showed me that everything is connected. The climate change is not just about some melting of some ice, but it has a far larger impact than we think at this moment. We are so lucky to experience this firsthand. We can show we've been there, we've seen what's going on. We should really do something about it.
The group's host in Barrow, director of the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium, Glenn Sheehan, was bound to be impressed by the energy and commitment of Art and his fellow students.
I think it has an impact. I think you really have to see this place to get a better understanding. We get a lot of politicians who come up here, and it's probably one of the few places you can be certain that it's not a joyride when they come up here.
Meanwhile, down by her boat in Barrow, hunter Jeannie Dipudeau never gives up. The battle to cope with global warming is yet another chapter in the ongoing struggle to keep the Inupiat culture alive, and she's confident in the next generation.
When we first started going to school, we'd get spanked for speaking our language, Inupiaq. But I never quit. They're teaching it in school now, which is really great. You know, everything I learn, I pass on to my daughter, and she's same traditional, you know. Anything we catch, we share. I was brought up that way.
And Jenny is not tempted by those who say an ice-free Arctic could provide a more comfortable lifestyle.
A lot of people would probably prefer it to be warmer, but I like it the way it is. I like the cold.
Irene Quayle with the Inupiat and the Climate Change College in Barrow, Arctic, Alaska.
Climate Change College was produced by Irene Quayle of Radio Deutsche Welle. It airs as part of Pole to Pole, an international media celebration of the International Polar Year, produced with support from the National Science Foundation. You can find the rest of that series online at our website, soundprint.org. There are listening links, as well as links to lots of additional information, both online and on paper. The address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Next time on Soundprint, our Pole to Pole series continues as we spend Thanksgiving at the bottom of the world. Life at McMurdo, next week on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint can be purchased for a small fee. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES to order your favorite episodes. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. We love hearing from you. Your feedback makes these collaborations and our regular programming better. So drop us a line at talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.